strike prevailing today in the occupied territories is a political message that the Palestinian people are standing behind the resistance option and to assert that they are following the footprints of the martyrs until victory and freedom. It's a message that the Palestinian people will not stand with their hands cuffed in front of the Israeli crimes and that they have the right to resist the occupiers.
Palestinian resistance factions have also urged Palestinians to take to the streets to denounce At-Tamimi's killing and the aggression by the Israeli regime. Sporadic protests also erupted in several areas of the West Bank. Protesters said they would offer as many martyrs for the sake of Palestine's freedom while fighting the Israeli occupation. They added that more action is required to respond to Israeli atrocities.
We are united as Palestinian people. We continue to prove that we have a strength to sacrifice our souls. We are ready to go to direct confrontations to resist the Israeli forces. We stand united behind the resistance, behind the confrontations, behind the martyrs.
Israel's escalating repression during the last month is part of a larger operation to quell the growing Palestinian resistance, particularly armed resistance. Recently, many Palestinian youths are drawn to this kind of resistance, with the newly formed group of fighters known as the Lion's Den as an example. Many might question whether a new uprising against Israel is in the making here in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. While the Israeli military is escalating its crackdown against Palestinians and using excessive force to counter the Palestinian resistance, it's obvious that Tel Aviv fears a renewed surge in anti-Israeli operations, especially after a rise in armed attacks against the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, Occupied Albira.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has been picked as the party's general secretary for a third time, which means that he will be the leader of China for another 5 years. In the 20th National Congress, the CPC, or Communist Party of China, highlighted its commitments to things like reducing inequality. That's a good cause. When it comes to hot-button issues like Taiwan, it refused to rule out the possibility of using force. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why China, or what China is going to do for the next 5 years and how that matters, especially at this point in time with the specter of the U.S. provoking it and drawing it into a war over a host of issues stands tall. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us from Geneva is Peter Koenig. He's a geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist. Welcome, Peter Koenig. And also we have from Detroit, Michigan, Haz Aldeen joining us. He's a political analyst and host of Infrared Show.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Peter Koenig, first I'll start with you. When we take a look at this next 5 years for Xi Jinping to have been picked, it's a good thing in terms of the commitments that he has given, in terms of things that he said he's going to cover, not only on the world scale but also domestically. But the way that the news is covered by some Western or many Western media outlets is he's holding on to power, extending his grip on power, surrounding himself with loyalists. Why do you think their take is different than the substance itself?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, I also think the re-election is a very good thing. It lends the country to more stability and continuity with the successful policy that he has certainly had in the past. We can talk about those too. I mean, what he has achieved. Now, the Western media, of course, and politicians, they have to criticize, they have to leave no good thing on China. So, but look at Madame Merkel, Germany's chancellor. She was in power for 16 years, was so-called re-elected four times, and nobody complained. The West applies different standards for what it perceives to be itself and her enemies. Now, the other thing that is also largely criticized, as you pointed out, that Xi Jinping surrounded himself with loyalists. Well, tell me one leader, including the U.S. and all of the Europeans and probably around the world, who doesn't set up a cabinet or a series of advisors that are not loyalists. I mean, this is normal. Any president does that, but why is it not correct if China does it? These are double standards, which I think we have to point out to the world and particularly to the media. So this is my take on these two issues. Now, if you like me to go into the achievements,
no, that's okay. We'll get into hopefully some of the areas that you deem also important on this. Hazeldine, I'm going to go to a couple, or really I should say one topic that seems to be one of the focus of this of the agenda of Xi Jinping for the next 5 years. And based on what has been covered in his speech, bolstering security and turning China into a technological power is very important for China. Now, we're going to get into technological aspect of it a little later, but national security, high on the agenda and a priority. Why do you think that's cited as a priority in the eyes of Xi Jinping?
Well, as China has entered a new phase of its historical development, which is moving out of the primary stage of modernization and industrialization that characterized the reform and opening up era, China is starting to be recognized around the world as a serious geopolitical player and superpower. And with that has come the understanding on part of the Chinese leadership that that's going to lead to an increased level of aggression and hostility from the world's premier superpower, which is the United States. So China has to prioritize national security now in ways that it wasn't before, because it is increasingly finding itself in the crosshairs of the State Department and the foreign policy agenda of the United States.
National security and then technology. Peter Koenig, those two have been covered out of this conference synonymously at the same time. And it's very interesting, the reason for that, which based on just some of the research done, it seems like the technological aspect is somewhat tied into what the U.S. has done recently when it comes to the issue of chips. We know that they've restricted access to the Chinese when it comes to chips. chips that, well, we know that they're for everyday appliances practically these days, but more importantly, it's used in the military arena. And the conclusion is that the U.S. is trying to prevent China from advancing in that field. Why do you think the U.S. wants to prevent China from advancing in that field?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure this can be taken seriously. I think this is more Biden's or the U.S. administration's bluff vis-a-vis the rest of the world. China is very much advanced in technology, in chip technology, and so on. China has almost all, if not all, of the raw materials, which means the rare earths that are needed for these technological approaches. So China has the capacity to be on its own. And that's why I wonder what is behind that. Of course, China needs to build up its military, and that is very clear. You pointed it out. You pointed out to the reasons, and I agree with them. Especially, I mean, there is more going on. There's NATO encroaching on China from all sides, particularly the South China Sea, and conflicts are brewing everywhere in order to restrain China. So it is very logical that China has to build up, and does, has been doing so for the past 2 years. Its army and its technological advances in the military, while maintaining, and I would like to stress that, while maintaining a peaceful approach to what they call the modernization of China, actually the new direction that they're going into by reaching out to the global south. But as far as the U.S. so-called sanctions is concerned, they sound and read like terrific. I mean, I think Biden has threatened U.S. citizens or technological experts in China. If they don't quit their jobs immediately, they lose their nationality. So what? I mean, China has the technology themselves to continue working on it. They also have, as I said, the raw materials. Uh-huh. So I'm not so sure whether this is a real threat or just bluff.
Well, based on the reports, it is a real threat. And it's interesting that you talk about rare earths, because, Hazeldine, China is not going to rule out not giving rare earths to the U.S., which would be a big catastrophe for the U.S. Exactly. In terms of the materials that are used that contain rare earths. But the mere fact that the U.S. wants to stop the advancement of another country in order for it to try to speed itself up and catch up, I guess that's one reason why the U.S. would do that. Or are we looking at the fact that China has passed the threshold in U.S.'s eyes when it comes to military prowess and strength, when it comes to hot-button issues, for example, Taiwan, which China has not ruled out using military force in terms of reunification? Of course, the U.S. has said we will defend Taiwan at the same time.
Well, yes, well, I think...
I'm sorry, Peter Koenig. This is for Hazeldine. Sorry, I'll get to you. Hazeldine, go ahead. Okay.
Yes, I think it speaks more to the more fundamental level of modernization and development of the productive forces that China has achieved, where now it's the United States which has to catch up with China. But the difference is, of course, that there was a time in which China felt like it had to catch up with the advanced countries and the Western world, and it did so by peaceful economic means, maneuvering its way through the complicated, you know, geopolitical and global political situation. The United States, in its attempt to catch up with China's level of not only technological advancement, but access to raw materials and resources and supply chains, can only do what it knows best and use political military force, rather than find some kind of cunning manner in the same way that China did to maneuver its way into catching up with China. The United States has to, I guess, achieve its economic goals at the barrel of a gun. And what it really speaks to as far as the United States' need to put China down and prevent China's development and growth is it's part and parcel with the United States' strategy, at least for the past few decades. The U.S. used to be the leader of global economic development, supposedly after the Bretton Woods period. Now the United States only seems like it can maintain its monopolistic position by directly halting and forestalling the development of other countries. whether it's through the IMF and their predatory loans, or through the use of military force to prevent other regional currencies from emerging, as we saw in the Middle East.
Well, Peter Koenig, in order to wrap our heads around what the U.S. wants to do with China, the facts should actually dictate the way we should see things. And that is, when you take a look at the way that China provides the types of goods that it does to countries around the world, it seems like it would just be very close to impossible for it to be taken out. Can't help but reflect on what EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell actually stated on October 10th, saying that the EU prospered because it got cheap gas from Russia and it was able to get the cheap labor and goods from China, and it was able to prosper. So doesn't the U.S. approach towards China mean that it's going to hit a dead end? And also, at what cost? And, of course, how China is going to react to U.S. aggression?
Well, yes, it's obvious. I mean, that China has been for the last how many, 20 years or maybe even more, a growing competition for the U.S. hegemony. And that is, of course, not acceptable for the U.S. Economy. I mean, the U.S. economy, basically right now, they can't supply anything that is competitive, not even replacement energy to the European Union, after having forced them to cut off the gas stream from Russia. I mean, this is asking the European Union to commit suicide, which they obviously are ready to do. But on the larger scale, it's true. Of course, the U.S. cannot compete with anything that comes from China, and I think this is the long term. This is the threat and the long term fear that the U.S. has, that there will be eventually a unification of Eurasia, and Eurasia includes, I mean, it's the hugest continent of our Mother Earth. That would include about two-thirds of the world population, and China, Russia, India, and Pakistan, and all these countries are going to be part of it. And so, if this happens, I mean, that's a logical step, because it's an non-interrupted area that would be economically so strong that there would be no other empire that could survive. And this is, I guess, the long-term threat that the U.S. perceives and wants to abolish, do away with Russia, and then, as a next step, or simultaneously, China. That's where why they're encroaching on both of these countries. Sure. So it's very clear. Yes, the European Union, of course, itself could be a threat, because they have 500 million people. They have a well-running economy. And if all countries, all the 27 countries, would put their economic output together, they would have a larger GDP than the one of the U.S. And that's why the European Union was never allowed to become a federation, like a one-country federation, like the United States of America.
Sure.
So this is very clearly the reason behind it.
Well, of course, the U.S. is trying everything it can in order to get the European companies onto U.S. soil with the type of energy deals that it's offering, moving towards green energy. But Hazeldine, the South China Sea is another topic that China needs to deal with when it concerns the U.S., because the U.S. is in China's backyard and is trying to maneuver itself and get other countries in that region behind it. Now, the big question is, Xi Jinping obviously realizes that, and conveniently, Xi Jinping is also the leader of the military of China. So, conveniently, he can direct that approach, the militaristic approach, if required. Do you think that in his vision, after being reelected for the next 5 years, that that's on his agenda and something he's going to act on, given the fact that the U.S. will act on its aggression, which all signs are pointing to that?
Yes, I think China, while ramping up its military capabilities, is going to maintain a fundamentally defensive position. I don't think China has any ambitions to tip the scales in any drastic manner itself, though I do think it's preparing for the United States to act rashly, whether in the South China Sea or elsewhere. And I think that's really the linchpin of China's overall geopolitical and military strategy here. They're not necessarily looking to start any kind of conflict or fight, but they're definitely preparing and perhaps even expecting the United States to initiate one.
Okay, so when you say that, it's interesting because let's just dial back in time and go back to a month or so ago, where in a span of, I think, a week or 2 weeks, you had all these U.S. officials visiting the island. The most notable one was Nancy Pelosi, which in the beginning, there were speculations as to why she would go, because she would be next in line if something were to happen to Joe Biden after the VP, of course. But then we saw all these trips by U.S. officials. That was intense provocation. And we saw with China, how China reacted. And it was a military posturing that China took. So when you say that, that goes against what we just saw happen during that past weeks. So do you still think that that will be the case, the defensive posture? Because that speaks of an old China. Maybe the new China in the next 5 years is not going to be like that.
Well, it should be. Oh, I don't know.
Okay, go ahead. Peter Koenig, to you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Hasseldine. I'll get to you, though. Go ahead, Peter Koenig.
All right. What I think is happening, and I think President Xi was very clear on that, that he says he plans to peacefully integrate Taiwan into the mainland of China, and accent on peacefully. That is a priority because it's an internal affair. However, what he also said, that if there is foreign intervention in this process, then China would use the military. And I think this is very, very clear, and it's also very difficult from the south. From the South China Sea, where the South China Sea is a very largely disputed territory and disputed mostly by the U.S. because they want to encroach on China from all ends. And there it could be very different. That China is putting up military bases on some of the islands, which it controls or pretends to control, and there the situation may be different. But I think, fundamentally, I agree with my colleague. I don't think they changed their posture of becoming aggressive, but rather defensive, but being better prepared for such a defense than they have been maybe henceforth.
So what is the threshold, though? Tell us, if you can tell us, what line would the U.S. cross when it comes to, let's say, Taiwan, that it would require a reaction from China?
Okay. Well, I think that threshold or red line has been made very clear. If Biden has said they will defend Taiwan at any time, if there's an active intervention in the case of, and I think that has already started, maybe clandestinely, not open to the public, sort of negotiations between Taiwan and mainland China. If there is an active intervention in this process by the U.S. or by anybody, by a proxy from Europe or somewhere else, then I think that would be the red line for China's military to intervene.
I see. So, Hasseldine, the economy obviously is something that China needs to deal with when it comes to not only the world, but also, of course, the U.S. that is trying to put a stick in the wheel, so to speak. Interestingly, when China rolled out the Belt and Road Initiative years and years ago, the U.S. did nothing really, but it came out through the G7 and offered its version of something to, I guess, counter the Belt and Road Initiative. It's called the Partnership for Global Infrastructure Investment. I don't know if you've heard of it, to mobilize $600 billion for middle and low-income countries.
Yes.
Well, it didn't really take off, Hasseldine. It hasn't really gone anywhere, and now we've gone through COVID and now, of course, the Ukraine conflict. Do you think that was a very unsuccessful and big and significant failure on the part of the G7 to stand up to China's Belt and Road Initiative?
Oh, I mean, undoubtedly. You know, the devil is always in the details. I have no doubt that the United States and its so-called allies can commit as much money as they want to kind of try and rival China's Belt and Road Initiative. But what they don't have is the more overreaching strategy, as well as the details about which companies are going to be building this infrastructure. How are they going to do it? Where are they going to do it? I don't see that global vision on part of the United States. that can rival China's as far as what it expects in terms of increasing global economic interconnectedness, mobilizing using China's most intricate levels of economic planning, state-owned enterprises and infrastructure companies in partnership with other countries and governments. I think what the United States really lacks in that department is a solid level of win-win diplomacy, mutual understanding between partners rather than one domineering empire giving orders and commands to others. And even regardless, China has already, if I recall correctly, committed some $900 billion to the Belt and Road Initiative since it began in around 2013. So even then, if the United States has any intention of trying to rival China's Belt and Road Initiative, it's going to have to deal with two realities. First, it's going to have to dismantle the special relationships China has cultivated with its partners in the Belt and Road Initiative and somehow replace them. And then second, it's going to actually have to catch up in terms of, you know, reaching the level of progress that China has already since 2013. And given the state of economic crisis now plaguing the United States and the internal political crisis within the United States, I just find that highly unrealistic.
Well, the part that I find unrealistic, correct me, Peter Koenig, about this Belt and Road and then the G7 and the U.S. coming up with their own version is, why doesn't the U.S. spend time, because it's infrastructure focused, why doesn't the U.S. spend money on its own infrastructure for the bridges that's falling apart and the schools that are not happening? And, of course, you know where I'm going with that. But I can see that from the little time we have, in less than a minute, China wants the U.S. to be driven out of its backyard. Do you think Xi Jinping is going to be successful in doing that now that he's been elected for the next 5 years? Less than a minute, please.
Yes, okay. Well, I think so, and I don't think necessarily that it will be Xi Jinping who is doing it. I think the U.S. is doing it to themselves. As you mentioned, the lack of reliable infrastructure in the U.S. is a tremendous burden for the public, and eventually they will revolt. They will call on the U.S. to fix their infrastructure themselves. I mean, this is clearly one of the priorities that any decent president would undertake in the U.S. before he goes abroad to try to gather more support from countries that they actually have usurped in the past. And with these 600 billion, actually they would, these 600 billion would come in the form of IMF and World Bank credits and would usurp further these countries. And they know that.
Okay.
That's why it's not successful.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Peter Koenig, geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist from Geneva. Hazeldine, thank you, political analyst and host at the Infrared Show from Detroit, Michigan. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwei and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Leaders meeting with group of academic elites. On Wednesday, 19th of October 2022, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of highly talented young scientists and outstanding academics of Iran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Wednesday, 19th of October, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of highly talented young scientists and academic elites. It should be noted that before the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, there were no outstanding world-class Iranian scientists and academics. But in 2016, according to the well-respected Web of Science website, there were 208 outstanding Iranian scientists and academics who were among the top 1% of world scientists. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, who has given his full backing to the growth of young scientific talent in Iran, having played a central role in establishment of various scientific and research institutions in the country, expressed his joy and gratitude that such a meeting has been arranged. The leader said, "I'm deeply, deeply thankful of Almighty God for allowing this joyful, lively and hope-inspiring meeting to take place once again, now that the coronavirus problem has been largely resolved. Indeed, the presence of you young people, especially young talented academics, generates hope. Your presence, wherever that may be, creates hope, and that is very important." The leader added, "I want to mention two or three points about who the elite are and what they do, and what do we expect from the country's academic elite. Regarding the scientific elite and the elite in general, first of all, we must know, I strongly believe that we should all know this, the scientific elite are one of the country's most precious assets. Yes, the country's natural resources are important. Their geographical location and climatic conditions are also very important. All of these are important, but the existence of these scientific elites is one of the country's most important assets. The elite should be considered a great asset. Once we consider them a great asset, that is when we will try to produce more of them and will consider it harmful to lose them. We will treat them with benevolence. Once we understand that they are a great and important asset for the country, our behaviour towards them will be shaped accordingly." In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution added, "The scientific elite, and basically the universities, are among the pillars of progress for this country. That is, universities are one of the most important pillars for the country's progress, and the main constituents of the universities are the scientific elite, the highly talented young scientists. The reason you see that, on different occasions, not just yesterday or the day before, attempts have been made to shut down universities or cancel classes so that students and professors won't go to classes is due to the fact that universities play a fundamental role in Iran's progress." Ayatollah Khamenei poignantly added, "I say this forthrightly and with courage. There is no doubt about it. With the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the needed infrastructure and background for development and growth of highly talented and outstanding young academics and scientists became available." In further remarks, the leader said, "Those who oppose the Islamic Republic cannot bear to see Iran progressing in science and technology and often deny Iran's scientific and technological advancement by prevarication, lies, and attempting to portray everything upside down." Ayatollah Khamenei added, "Universities are one of the greatest obstacles that stand in the way of the arrogant powers. We need to realize that the goal of the world's aggressors is to dominate. By what means? One day they use weapons, another day they use deception, and the next day they use science. They also dominate using science. Universities prevent their domination. This means that if you can raise the scientific status of the country,
you are creating a real impediment, a real barrier to domination by the enemy. So that's another important point about academic elite and universities. In further remarks, the leader said, another point to note is that one element in creating the academic elite is their natural talent, good thought, good mind, good brain, which are all divine gifts. This is not someone's doing, rather it is God-given. Now, why God has given these people this talent is a whole different topic for discussion. The Almighty God has blessed this academic elite of ours with a powerful brain, a good mind, preparedness and alertness, and that's one element. The second element that makes someone an academic elite is their endeavour, their efforts and hard work. Otherwise, there are plenty of people who have this God-given gift, but they don't work, they don't put in any effort, and they don't strive, and they don't get anywhere. They have no self-growth, and they don't help the country either. We have had plenty of these people, we'll still have them, and there were even more of them in the past. So the second element that is required for creating an academic elite is related to their effort and perseverance. Turning to flourishing and spreading of universities in Iran, the leader said, which part of the country have you seen where there isn't a university? Now, some complain that universities have been established in some places without the necessary facilities. Very well, so the motivation to establish a university was there. That's very important. There are universities all over the country. The universities in some remote cities are outstanding. A person can see this. They have very good lecturers, distinguished professors lecturing at universities in certain remote cities. We know some of them. So that is about spread of universities. And there are the academics. The number of academics, both students and professors, has increased. The number of students in the country, now I have mentioned these statistics many times before, but I don't remember it exactly right now. The sources weren't available to me when I was writing down these notes. There has been a 25-fold increase in the number of students in the Islamic Republic of Iran, a 25-fold increase compared to pre-revolutionary levels is very high. Lecturers in the first years after the revolution, around 1980 or 1981, when I was discussing issues related to universities, there were about 5,000 faculty members in the country as a whole. Today, there are well over 100,000 faculty members. There are over 100,000 faculty members. The country's population has more than doubled in this period of time. But the increase in faculty members has been astounding 20-fold. These are important matters. These statistics speak for themselves. And this clearly shows what the Islamic Revolution has accomplished. There is, of course, a multitude of research institutes in the country, think tanks and research institutes. They're abundant in many parts of the country. The scientific development we're seeing in the country is something that is really valuable. It is part of the groundwork that is needed for nurturing the elite, the highly talented young scientists and engineers. We should truly appreciate the academics. Our academics have not allowed the country to become dependent on the West. Because when a country has universities but no professors, one of the things that comes to mind is to get professors from outside of the country. But our academics did not allow this to happen. They trained people to become professors instead. Around 90% of Iranian professors today have come from the generation that was trained by our own university professors. They worked hard and put in the effort. The Islamic Republic wanted to expand its universities and make them powerful, and thankfully this has happened today.
Universities also took advantage of this historical opportunity and developed themselves. And this is one issue. Another issue is that it is not an exaggeration when I say that the academic elites of the country have become a source of honour for the Islamic Republic of Iran. You are the young generation of elites. There were many elites before you, the generations before you, who brought honour to this country during the past 40 years. Whatever issue our scientists encountered and focused on, they did something that garnered admiration within the world's scientific community. For example, the research and achievements of Royan Research Institute, not just regarding stem cell research, but also in cloning of live animals. This was something rare in the world, but it happened here in the Islamic Republic. I saw those living animals myself. I'm not narrating from others. I went and saw the living animals that had been cloned and created, and there wasn't just one, there were quite a few of them. We have seen these things happen. It was not a small task. May God's mercy be upon the soul of Professor Kazemi Ashtiani, and he was the one who laid the foundation for this, and then our brothers, who are there now, pursued it and have reached this stage now. That's one example. Advancements in biochemistry and achieving a UNESCO chair in biochemistry, they have admitted it themselves. You know that in these international chairs, one of the basic tasks of the enemy is to interfere, infiltrate, and prevent Iran from getting a seat and becoming a member state. Despite this, our outstanding scientists and elites have achieved this victory. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei continued by saying, "Another example is that we've sent satellites into space. Only a few countries have done this. Not all countries have this technology. A lot of countries have satellites in space, but they are incapable of launching the satellites themselves. There are only a few countries that have launched satellites into space. Of course, we are behind, but we launched these satellites. We were able to do it. Our scientists concentrated on this, and now one of our brothers here mentioned that these things have been achieved in the field of space and aerospace research. For example, building a humanoid robot at Tehran University is also very important and a great achievement. Fundamental achievements in the nuclear industry, the issue of peaceful nuclear technology, has a long story. There is a lot to be said in this regard, but our time is limited. We have gained access to fundamental issues in nuclear industry. We are not seeking weapons or bombs or anything like that, but this industry itself has many benefits, and we were able to gain access to peaceful civilian nuclear technology." Well, these are the things that the Iranian academic elite have accomplished. These things are truly a source of honour for the country. Another example is the production of complex vaccines, including the COVID-19 vaccine and the like. There are many examples, that's another point, that the Iranian elite and scientists have been able to provide the country with honour. I'm saying these things because I want you all, the academic elite, the highly young, talented elite, to appreciate yourselves. I want those sitting outside to appreciate you. I personally have great appreciation for you, and I hope that we will be able to help you in the future. As for the third element, I already spoke about two other elements. This third element now, that makes you an academic elite, that makes you become an elite, is the element of divine guidance and assistance from the Almighty. Without a doubt, you need God to pave the way for you and provide you with divine guidance in order to become, to be considered an elite. Merely having talent and using this talent doesn't make someone into an academic elite. Another point is that our academic elite should be shown bright horizons. Some people make our elite lose hope and paint a dark future for them. That is certainly not the case. The horizon for young, highly talented Iranian scientists and engineers is very bright indeed. This should be known by all of you, and you should all be encouraged. Professors, higher education managers and media, whether it be the state media or the press, and owners of knowledge-based industries and companies, as some of you have also mentioned, should create and encourage an atmosphere for the academic elite. Today, discouraging the elite, making them lose their hope in the future, is, in my opinion, the enemy's soft war strategy against the Islamic Republic. The enemy is striving to show a bleak future for our elite. Now, I should also add that the country does have its weak points. I'm not denying this. There is not only a few, but many weak points. However, we need to see the strengths alongside the weaknesses. The enemy strives to magnify the weaknesses and cover up our strengths, and we should not help the enemy in this regard. And this is the last thing that I would like to speak about. I will talk about this horizon and how we can correct it. Since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, the West has waged a propaganda campaign against Iran, in which they claim that the Islamic Republic is declining. They would say it was declining from the very first days. Sometimes they would say that the Islamic Republic will be finished in 2 months' time, or in 1 year's time, or in 5 years from now, and they would set specific dates. Some people inside the country also promote these claims, either out of neglect or with malevolent intentions. After the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, passed away in 1989, there were a number of people, among whom there were some well-regarded and experienced individuals, who made declarations about how the government is on the edge of an abyss. They tried to imply that the government would collapse any day now. That was back in 1989. In 2003, a number of parliamentarians wrote a letter to me. It was really an unfair letter. Very unfair. They said some things and they asked some questions that they had to answer themselves. Because both the parliament and the government at the time were in their hands. They needed to answer those questions, but they were demanding answers from me. In summary, the letter stated that you need to surrender, otherwise you'll be finished. That was back in 2003. We did not surrender, of course. We stood up to them, and God willing, we shall continue to do the same. Our enemies have kept doing this repeatedly. The thing that we should look at this context is to see what our analysis of the situation is. Let's conduct a proper analysis. There are two analytical systems that exist. One analytical system believes that standing up to the widespread global norms is useless and there's no point in doing it. They say that there are international norms and governments who have formed and have gained power based on these norms. The powerful and wealthy United States has been shaped according to these norms. Europe is the same. Other countries are the same. Don't waste your time standing up to these norms. You'll be destroyed. That's one kind of analysis. The second type of analysis is more realistic. This type of analysis sees the reality, not just the good facts, but the bad facts as well. I have never denied the weaknesses. In the meetings that I have with officials, in the Ramadan gatherings, I point out the weaknesses more than anything else, and I do so much more in our private meetings. We pay attention to the weaknesses. It's not that we do not notice them. I have said many times before that we are behind. There is no doubt in that. But on the other hand, we started a rapid movement from the end of the line, and now we are almost at the front of science and technology. And this is an excellent and an inspiring fact. Look at where the Islamic Republic was 40 years ago and where it is now today. Look at where it was 20 years ago and where it is now today. After 4 decades, we can understand which of these 2 analyses has been realistic.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.